Hello and welcome to my talk. I had been looking so much forward to meeting you all in person this year, but sadly I don't feel entirely comfortable traveling to Germany right now, so that'll be for next year. And then again, when I'm there in person, I can't do this. Or this. But to be honest, that's a small price to pay because I really like being there in 2019, and I so much hope that I'll be able to be there in 2022. This talk is not about old computers. This talk is about me acquiring and organizing the information needed to write a book about old computers. I could have spent 5 years getting a master's degree in history, but I chose to go the learning by doing way. And oh boy, I have already learned a lot, and I didn't even really start to write anything yet. So don't hold back on any good advice. Leave a comment on YouTube or send an email or write on Twitter. All my contact information will be on the last slide. So, my name is Mike. I was born in 1983. During the day, I'm an infrastructure engineer. I do software development and I'm an open source specialist. By night, the keywords are vintage computing fanatic, author, historian, born hack, Danish Society for Computer History, YouTube, musician, hungry, curious, and I just love taking things apart. And then I'll just spend 20 seconds plugging my YouTube channel because I do a lot of YouTube videos about old computers, about history, where I play with old computers, I restore them, and I showcase them. Go check it out. Initially, these computers were classic CPM systems with around 48 to 64 kilobytes of memory, 1 to 4 megahertz of clock frequency. First, it was running the development language COMEL as a primary operating system. The CPM part didn't come by until later. The first machine I got to know was the Comet 3000, which my dad had. And to be honest, that was it for many, many years for my concern. Not until like I was 20, 28, 30 years of age, like 10 years ago, I started thinking about what else was back then. And then in my mid-30s, I started this project because I joined the Danish Society for Computer History and wanted to look into these computers and started asking around and figured out there was quite a lot of machines both before and after this one. So the first machine, the MPS 2000, and even before that, there was a kit version you could buy and assemble yourself. These machines originally used the small tape drives, if you know, from dictaphones, like 5 centimeters wide, for data storage. Later on came floppies, and finally, of course, at some point, it started using hard drives. I really wanted an overview of these machines, who invented them, which machines were made, and what were they used for, and what were the specifications, and nobody had that list for me. I tried Wikipedia, nothing there. I also tried the library. And when I went to the library, I discovered that these books did not exist. There was no books about the Comet and no books about the company behind. There were several books about other Danish companies such as Regnecentralen, which is another large, huge Danish company building computers. It's a cool company, no doubt about that. But why can we have a book about that and not about the Comets? The machine was mentioned a lot of places. As a notorious quote I found somewhere in a book about general Danish computers. This book was not a history-oriented book. It was a book from back then, which you could read in order to figure out which computer you should buy for your school. And they said one of the most popular systems for the education sector in the 80s was the Comet. How on earth don't we have a book on that? So all this was based on the knowledge I had back then, which I admit was not a lot. I had a lot of assumptions. First of all, I said the company behind the Comet. There wasn't one company. There was a lot of companies. And about the Comet, there was not only one Comet. There were several, both before and after. And I became a lot smarter. And I became a lot smarter because I decided to write that book myself. So when you're writing a book about something that happened only 30 to 40 years ago, you might actually have the opportunity to go talk with some of the people from back then. That is super obvious, isn't it? Yeah, I wasn't that lucky. It was super hard to get in touch with all the people I felt I needed to talk to. John Doe, the software developer, actually was one of the first I talked with. He actually found me because he have heard that I was looking into this. More details about that later. But he contacted me and I got the story from him. And he also confirmed some of the things I thought and rejected some of the things I was convinced of wrongly. It was a super nice talk. And of course, that's not his name and it's not his picture either. I'm using all stock photos for this for illustrative purposes. We had a nice talk and I learned a lot. And then just when we were about to tie up our talk, he was just like, by the way, I got the source code for the machines for you and send it to me in an email. And I was just like, what? I mean, I didn't even ask for that. And now suddenly out of nothing, I had the source code for the BIOS for the machines. I felt like somebody just handed me like $1 million. I was so shocked. It was awesome though, but yeah. Okay. So, Jørgen Høgh, the owner of 88 Electronic, which were the company I thought produced the Comet computers. It turned out that he actually produced some of them, the majority of them. Jørgen Høgh was super hard to find, and the company was also super hard to find. But after some research, I found out that he had a son who was a very skilled hunter. And I managed to get a hold of the son, and the son put me in contact with the father. And as soon as I got to talk with him, he was super willing to help me and sent me a lot of documentation and spent like 2 hours talking with me. So I got a lot of nice information out of that guy. Then we got the hardware engineer, Mogens Pelle. First, he didn't want to talk to me. He referred me to the Danish Society for Computer History, which was where I said I was from. So that confused me a bit. I sensed a bit of bitterness in him. So I kept on working on him, talking to him and trying to convince him to help me. And in the middle of Corona, he accepted to talk to me. So that was super nice. And we started talking, and wow, suddenly I realized why he was bitter. So the short story is that in the middle of this project, which he more or less started himself, he was kicked out that's where the stories differ. But yeah, let's just say some people didn't like some people and there were differences working together, so he was kicked out. He got really, really pissed about that. I don't know if he got pissed about that, but he started his own company and started producing his own successor to the Comet 2000. I'm not going into details about it, but he built this company and started punching way above his weight. More about that later, but already here from the beginning we have a split. The director and the engineer goes opposite directions. I didn't expect to find something like that, but yeah, that's if I ever want to write a movie about this, this is going to be some of the focal points in this movie where the past differs. For now, it's just a book, and I don't really care about action in the book. I care about the book being correct, which is pretty hard because Mogens don't remember that well. I mean, the things he remember like almost perfectly. But if I ask him, like, what did you do that day back then? He can't remember it. If I ask, do you remember that day you did so and so? Then he can remember it and he most likely will confirm it and add something on top I didn't know, which I later confirmed. So it's like you have to kickstart his memory. A bit challenging, but I can work with it. He's a super nice guy and he has helped me a lot. The last guy on this sheet, this is not the last guy in the book at all. This was just the four most important, or the four first persons I chose to mention, is the representative of ICL. I actually talked to him. He's an old guy, super nice old guy, but he started telling me that my memory is not that good. I only know 8 stories, But my wife says I keep telling the same 8 stories over and over again. So, and he did. So, yeah. I didn't really get much out of him. But I did talk to him, and he said something and confirmed something. So, I guess that's something. And then I started digging into the different parts of the story, and suddenly it all blew up in my face. So, this project expanded into Komal. I just mentioned the comments were booting Komal in the beginning. It turned out that Børge Christensen, who is the author behind, or the inventor behind Komal, was actually one of the main forces pushing on the development of these machines. Mogens Pelle initially only wanted to build these machines and then give the recipe more or less for free so everybody could build their own computers. And that led me on to USA, because Komal expanded into most of the world. The comments didn't, but Komal did. And that was an interesting story. I wanted to include that as well. Then we had a lot of magazines, AFD, MPS group, the MCUG, different user groups. We had the 3F Factory, the People's Television Factory, like a socialist factory built in Western Denmark in the 70s. That turned into something called Horsodan and other industries from that area, because they went bankrupt in the late 70s. That factory was supposed to build a machine, but didn't, or maybe it did. I'm not sure, but I started going down that rabbit hole as well. Another company called Data Inform was actually also selling the Comet computers. It wasn't building them, it was just buying them from ATS Electronic and selling them. That was also a really interesting company, which also was another rabbit hole I went down through. And in general, I more or less started documenting the educational brands of the IT sector in Denmark in the 1970s. There was this computer teaching magazine, which was the Danish organization for computer science teachers, printed a magazine. And that also opened up a lot of rabbit holes for me. I discovered a company called Bugica Data, another called Instrotech, which sold Commodore, something called Soul Data, something called Unicomal. And all these stories became new rabbit holes I started exploring. So I had to learn to restrict myself. I'm not good at that. Some of these stories is not going to be part of the book, but some of them are. One of the most funny parts is that the story about the priest and the chimney sweeper from a small town in Jutland is actually going to be part of the book, because those two guys did something really important for the history of the Comet machines. And that is kind of what I decided to go with. So something might be interesting, but that's not enough. It must have some direct tie to the Comet machines in order to be included in the book. A couple of exceptions, of course, there are always exceptions, but yeah. So now I started figuring out which sources I wanted to look through. And one of the first and most obvious sources was the old computer magazines from back then. The beginning of this journey actually started with an article written in 1985 by a guy called Ole Grünbaum, not German. Well, I don't know. His Danish, at least, might have German descent. I don't know. He wrote an article about these Comet computers back in 1985, where he actually went out to the factory and interviewed the people working there and the owner and described the place. And until I read that article, I didn't even know where the factory was. I couldn't find it. But based on that article and some other documents, I figured out the address of the company. And then I figured out, and I found the company in the company register. And that was the beginning of me being able to even contact them. Also, I read a lot of national newspapers. And some of the most significant pieces of information I found in a newspaper was the name of 3F, the People's Factory, the People's Television Factory, the socialist factory I talked about on the previous slide. And that opened up the path for something called SUC, the Southern University Center of Denmark. That and a whole bunch of other interesting pieces of information was uncovered just by reading the newspaper from 1970-something. Another fun side story. This magazine you see on the screen right now is actually claiming to be the first Danish computer magazine. However, if you read this issue number 4 and you read the article about the comet, you will actually read them describing an earlier computer magazine. So they kind of knew they were not the first, but they still claim it. That was a bit fun. Anyway, this about the press and the old newspaper articles, I keep thinking in 30 years or so, the place to find this kind of information will most likely be Facebook and Twitter and websites to a certain degree. But do we really have real usable archives of Facebook and Twitter? And will this survive until, I don't know, 2060, where the next history like this will need to be written? I don't know. I think it's pretty interesting. Another interesting source of information is advertisements in both magazines and newspapers and what have you. Even small companies had ads in local newspapers, but larger companies had larger ads and had large in larger newspapers. So you could kind of measure how large they were, depending on how many ads they ran. And also the three great companies who are the three largest companies who produce computers in Denmark actually put up an ad like telling me that this week we have been getting this customer, this customer, this customer, this customer, listing all the customers. So I could use these advertisements to actually call the schools and say, hey, I know you bought this in the 1970s. Do you by any chance have some of them left? I actually got in touch with quite a bit of schools who had the computer still that way. And also in general, you could just see out of the ads what were being sold in Denmark back then. I mean, the Apple II was available, but it was expensive as, yeah, you know, but it was available. And all that information could also be coupled with the company selling them. And actually, I tried calling some of the companies. Most of them doesn't exist anymore, but many of them were just a single employee who a self-employed person. And often that same person lives at the same address and I could actually contact him. And some of them actually sometimes still have some of the old stock or maybe some of the old documentation. So advertisements is a super interesting source of information. One of the sad things is that those are not indexed. In Denmark, we have this huge database of every published media going back to, I don't remember, way, way longer back than I need. But they don't make the ads searchable. Sometimes it happens by chance, but it's not like there's a huge database of advertisements ever ran in Denmark or anywhere else. At least I haven't found them yet. Maybe we should make that. Talking about archives. In Denmark, we have quite a bit of our government archives. As mentioned before, I learned about SOC from the newspaper, which closed down in the 90s. A local archive in Esbjerg had their files, and I got access to them just by asking. I mean, this is an educational institution, and most likely there would have been sensitive information in these archives. But I was just like, yeah, that sounds like a reasonable story. Here you have 20 boxes. Just go through them. If you want to copy anything, there's a copy machine out in the back. Feel free to use it. Okay? No control of what I read or what I copied. They just trust me. Don't get me wrong. I like that. But I was a little bit surprised. I would have expected that at least I would have to show copies of, show the copies I made, but no. It was in these boxes I found the documentation that proved where the first machines of this kind were built and who built them. And it also proved that Børge Christensen, the author of Komal, was way more involved than is publicly known. For good reasons, I think, because Børge Christensen was a man of the academia in the 70s, and being connected to commercial interests back then was frowned upon, and he could not go out to the schools and say, you need to buy this computer, if people knew he had a hand in producing this computer, especially not if he would make money on it. And he later told newspapers that he didn't earn anything on the computers or on Komal in general. The only thing he earned money on was the books he sold, which is okay in academia. For some reason, you can sell books, but not computers. Anyway, we also had the Danish National Archive. That was a bit more tied with security. They had some files regarding ICL. However, the problem with ICL was that it never went bankrupt. They were being sold and merged into another company. So the stuff that the archive had about ICL was very limited. Basically, it was a box of pictures that were dated way before what I was interested in. And it was a lot of some documents from the employee organization documenting their picnics and their Christmas dinners and things like that. So not really anything interesting to me. But it was a nice experience visiting the Danish National Archive. I was not strip searched, but I was allowed to bring one computer and one charger, and I had to open the computer to show them that I didn't have any documents inside of the computer. I had to show them if I had a block for taking notes. I had to show them that there was no papers inside, and when I left, I had to show them that I hadn't added any papers inside. That was pretty interesting. One of the things I discovered at the National Archive, though, were that they had a set of boxes for the school that Børge Christensen, the guy who invented Komal, worked at. And that school sent, Børge sent, when he worked at that school, he sent physical letters to SUC, the other school that I just mentioned. I found these documents in the local archive at Esbjerg. And I was just, it could be cool if I could find a copy of them at the other school as well. But those documents are classified because for some reason, personal information when it's at a government school are more classified than if they are at a small local school. So I tried to figure out what it would take to get access to these documents. And then I got surprised yet again. I only had to ask. Then a guy would say, but what do you need them for? I'm writing this book. And the guy says, that sounds reasonable. Here are the documents. Just don't publish anything you're not supposed to. And I was just like, okay, no guidelines or anything. No. Just don't publish anything you're not supposed to publish. No controls, no checks, no anything. It was just, here are the boxes. I haven't looked at them yet, but I'm going to very soon. But there are no controls. I will just be allowed to look through the papers and copy anything I want. I will have to prove that the copies are copies. Most likely, I'll just scan them and transfer them to my email, so I won't bring out any papers from the National Archive. But again, I was super impressed that I have a reasonable story. I'm writing a book. Okay, you got access. I even talked to privately owned archives. I'm not going to mention any names here, but like companies, and asked them to see their private files. And often, they are super willing to help and have given me access to look at their files. I have promised most of them not to tell anything about it, so I'm not going to. But in general, people are super nice, and if you ask them and say, hey, I am writing this book, will you help me? Most people will help you. I didn't expect that. A few exceptions, again, not mentioning any names, but a large Danish producer of toys refused to talk to me at all because according to the new GDPR rules, you're not allowed to say anything about anybody ever working for the company. That's not true. But it's a good excuse not to do any work. I guess that's why they didn't do it. That pissed me off a bit. But yeah, I'll manage. So, but it was just fun. So the smaller the company are, I felt the better the chance are that they're actually willing to help you. Okay, regarding government archives, in Denmark, we have this thing called the Central Business Register, which is a governmental archive who keeps track of every official changes to any business in Denmark, both currently existing businesses, but also historical. The Central Business Register sounds really boring and insignificant, but this is where I uncovered funding and founders of new companies, bankruptcies, mergers, name changes, name of directors and board members, old addresses and addresses which are used to expand on the search terms in other places. So if you look at the first picture here, current companies, which is present back to around 1985, most information is free. If you want original documents, you have to pay a relatively small fee, but you will receive them through email, most likely. For older companies, which means companies from 1985 to 1949, you basically pay 20 euros for a PDF file, and somebody else will look it up and email it to you. Yeah, well, that's what you see in the middle. That's a PDF I paid for. I don't mind paying for PDFs, but I already pay this through my taxes. If you go to really old companies, it gets reasonable again, because now, pre-1949, you pay the same 20 euros, but now somebody has to go down in the basement somewhere in Copenhagen and find a shelf filled with old microfilms, take the specific film out and create hard copies of whatever is on that film, scan it into a computer. They make hard copies and mail them with physical mail to your address. So in these documents, I found some of the really early history about ICL. ICL originally was a lot smaller companies, British companies, and the government back in around 1949, the British government wanted a European competitor to IBM. So the force merged a couple of British companies together. Most of them, there was a computer company and there was a tabulator company, you know, punch cards and sorting and things like that. They forced a merger there. And that merger was forced in Denmark as well. And it was, I don't have all the details yet. They will be in the book. But it's super interesting, and I'm currently waiting for more documents to arrive because they have a couple of weeks of delivery time. So I got the documents for ICL, looked through them, and all the way back to 49, I could see this company was funded by a merger between A and B. And then I was just like, okay, I want to know the information about A and B as well. And then I had to file two new requests to get those documents. Still waiting for that. And I paid 20 euros for each of those as well. Another funny story, back in the mid-80s, some of the companies started a bit of a fight over the right to the name Kummel. And there was actually a case with the Danish Patent Office, which is the office in Denmark who takes care of trademarks. And that case, I requested a copy of that case, and that was not a problem. I could have that. However, they lost the case. I actually had a worker spending about 2 weeks searching for that file and coming back to me and saying, we're really sorry, we can't find the file. We can see it in the systems, but we don't know what it's about because the physical papers are gone. That's kind of a bummer. Anyway, another and even more important source of information are user group publications. Some are run for by companies, most likely the companies who produce the machines or the software for said user group. Some are paid for by the user themselves, and some are paid for by interest groups like the Danish Computer Science Teachers Magazine. And another one of the rabbit holes I ended up going down through was all the private user groups, and most notably, their disk archive or their BBSs. So all the way back in the days, they would have a disk archive, and in their monthly magazine or quarterly or something, they would print a list. This is the files we have now. Send us an empty floppy with a written letter stating which files you want, and we'll ship back the floppy with the files. So that was the early days of file sharing. Most user groups only shared, you know, public domain and shareware. But officially at least that was the only thing they did. Probably a lot of things happened behind the scenes. But I was this close, and I still am this close to uncovering a couple of the old disk archives. And that's kind of a big rabbit hole. Originally, I started looking because in one of the listings, it said it had the source code for the Comet 2000. I mentioned earlier that I got the source code for the Comet. That was the Comet 3000. The Comet 2000 is a whole different machine. And I did not have the source code for that back then. I do now. I found it somewhere else. I found a hard copy of it, and then I found somebody who typed it in. And it's actually about, right now, he's about to test it on a physical machine that he's restoring. Interesting. And that is most likely gonna be, a whole other chapter or a YouTube video or something, because that's an interesting project. At least two whole magazines were started on the basis of the Comet 2000. And we know of at least two others which played a significant role in the beginning of these machines. One of them was responsible for the creation of the machine, and one of them mentions the machine as part of the, I think, the second episode they ever made. This was the NASCOM News. And actually, the NASCOM News was so simple that it was actually written on a typewriter, and then it would be stitched together with tape and photocopied at the local library. So there was no printing press involved, which means that it was not sent off to the Royal Library for preservation purposes. So the only reason why we have that is because that the last president of that company, not that company, but that club, that organization, that user group, had the sanity to save a copy of each magazine all the way from when they started to when they shut down, actually just before COVID. So, fun story, he donated the rest of the organization's money to the Danish Society for Computer History. And we didn't pay any notice to it until like a year later, where we discovered what had happened. And I like hurried up and called them and said, "Do you still have the documentations?" And luckily, the guy still had them, and I got to borrow them. And I have just spent the last few evenings in the Data Museum, which is what we call the facilities that the Danish Society for Computer History currently resides in. We have a professional document scanner, which will very gently take a whole bunch of papers and scan them each by the time. And it's very gentle, and I have never seen it rip anything apart. If there's anything unusual it detects, it'll just stop. And you can open it up and take the paper out and flatten it or remove the paper clip or whatever's wrong and just run it again. Super nice machine. So in very short time, we will have a digital copy of one of the first Danish user group magazines. Super interesting. But in general, these magazines were an awesome source to figure out who played with these machines. Usually there would be a list of both the board members and the president, and sometimes also of the members of the organization in these user group publications. And also people would build their own hardware and their own software, and they would announce it in these magazines. They would also have events which were also announced in these magazines. It is more or less a printed version of a Facebook group these days. So whatever happened would be in these books. And then I don't need to tell you why that is a huge, huge source. And if you look at the two larger publications in the background, the one who says data information and the one who says the comet, kometen in Danish, kometen. I don't know how to pronounce that in English. Those were actually released by the companies producing the computers. So that was the thing. And the blue one is actually produced by Mogens Pelle's company. Mogens Pelle was the one who got kicked out of the project and decided to roll his own. And if I compare what I see in these magazines, he had actually built a company which had produced more or less the same amount of machines, employed the same amount of people as the two larger competitors, Regnecentralen and ICL. Of course, both companies had way more people employed at all, but in that exact department doing the competing with Mogens Pille, they were about equally sized. That was pretty impressive, actually. And to be honest, I think he had a fair chance of beating them, were it not for that IBM came in and beat all three of them at once during the 80s. So, yeah, 8-bit CPM computers, yeah, didn't stand a chance. So this was all about things I could dug up myself. I mean, going through old papers and old newspapers and old publications, I can do that myself. But I needed to get in touch with people, and calling everybody in Denmark was not an option. Oh well, at least not if I had to do it myself. So I had to come up with a strategy. And the strategy I came up with is very simple. Stick your head out there. So this was a conscious strategy. First, I decided to start a YouTube channel. I already talked about that. But I have more or less turned myself into the biggest serious retro YouTuber in Denmark. Of course, there are gamers and there are people who play with these computers, and there are, but I'm not aware of anybody with a larger following than me who works within restoration and preservation and the history of these machines. Besides from that, I started blogging for something called Version2/The Engineer, which is a Danish online media, the largest tech outlet in Denmark, more or less, funded by the Danish Union for Engineers and yeah, other technical people. It's not only, you don't have to be an educated engineer, you can also just work in the field. So that's a pretty broad union, and it has a lot of traffic. And I use it to drive traffic to my YouTube channel and my other outlets. After Vintage Computing Festival Berlin in 2019, I had an article published in another physical media called Alt om Data, Everything About Data, which is actually one of the oldest Danish magazines around computers. And the last one I had was in this spring. I actually called up the local newspaper in Horsens, which is a town where the factory I talked about earlier, 3F, the People's Television Factory, resided. And I talked to the editor of the newspaper and said, I'm looking for people who knows anything about this. Can we run an article about that? Will you help me with that? And he said, yes. Again, calling people, asking them for favors, that works. I'm not demanding anything. I'm just saying, hey, I have this project. I don't have any money. Well, I didn't say that, but I implied that. Can you help me? I expected him to ask me to pay for an ad or something, but he was just like, sure. Can you write something up and send me some pictures and I'll look over it? And I sent him a small article and a couple of pictures. And then he called me up and interviewed me. And instead of this small article I made, he made a whole double-sided piece about the Danish Society for Computer History, about me and about this computer, and urged everybody to reach out to me. And that works. And based on this strategy, I also funded relationships with a lot of Danish museums. So now museums will call me and say, we found this thing. We didn't understand it. Can you help us? And of course, I'm a member of the Danish Society for Computer History. And through that, I also made connections. So people there knows that if they hear about the comet or somebody knowing something about them, that they need to put them in touch with me. This strategy works. It's very efficient. It might be hard to replicate, but it works. Some of the big scores based on my YouTube channel, I actually got a donation of a lot of parts for the Comet 2000. That was before I had even come close to a working model. We don't have a working model yet, but we maybe know where there is a working prototype. That was what I talked about before, about the guy who was trying out the source code for it. There's a prototype that may be working. Anyway, we got a keyboard. Oh, well, chassis for it, and we got the keycaps and the switches, not the PCB or all the metal that's supposed to tie the PCB to the casing. But we figured out that it's actually a standard unit. So it's a Cherry keyboard. I think it's a Cherry Pro 90 keyboard, which is used in the casing. So that gives us a bit of a larger chance to get one. So I got an agent on eBay waiting for it to pop up there at some point. Hopefully that will happen. Then we got this huge score of lost official records. You see it here in the middle. I got a call from the president of the Danish Society for Computer History. He said, we have a call somewhere close to you. There's a guy who just died. And one of his friends found some old Comet computers. Will you go there and take a look at them? I said, of course I want to do that. As I drove there, I accidentally left my phone on silent. So I didn't hear that the friend who had called the data museum had tried to call me, which was quite lucky, because when I got there, he received me in the yard and said, I'm so sorry, I tried to call it, but I couldn't get through. I actually can't find the machine, so I actually wanted to cancel. And I was just like, okay, but it was only a Comet 3000, which we have plenty of, so I wasn't that heartbroken at this point. But I was just like, I drove all the way out here. Why don't we have a look at it together and see what we can find? So we spent a couple of hours looking through this old farmhouse, and we found the machine. That's not important, because we also found a whole shelf filled of old documents from back then. I recognized the binder which ICL used immediately. It's screaming orange. No, I don't have any hair right now. It is screaming orange, and I just know that color. Anyway, we looked through those documents and discovered a whole heap of lost official records. So back then, Denmark was divided into municipalities. There was a couple of hundred of those. Those were organized in counties, and then again, that was organized in under the state. The counties has been, what is it called? We don't have counties anymore in Denmark. The counties had this responsibility for buying educational materials. And this guy, which was an old teacher, had been part of a board who were tasked with purchasing the first computers for this county. So there was communication with Regnecentralen, with ICL, with Børge Christensen and Mogens Pelle, and a lot of other companies as well. And there was a meeting of this group talking to each other, mailing through to each other, visiting different companies and visiting ICL in England. This was a treasure trove of knowledge. I mean, this is really significant and was so lucky. And again, I don't trust luck, but sometimes it is a thing. I couldn't have planned for this. There was no way I could have planned for this and find this person. And the funny thing is, when I called up Mogens Pelle and said, hello, Mogens, the guy, I can't tell his name because he's dead, and this is a matter of public records, so it's not a problem. And I said, I just got these papers from a guy called Jørgen, and Mogens never talked about about Jørgen before, but when I mentioned his name, he was, oh, so Jørgen is dead. That's sad. And I was just like, he remembered him instantly and could recall lots of what was in those documents before I even told him that. By the way, regarding public documents and lost records. So what happened is that all these documents has more likely been put into boxes and shipped off to the Danish National Archives and been there ever since. It's not like I can search for which documents are there. I tried, and I can't find them. And it's not like I can say I want the documents for the IT committee in 1978. No such thing. There's probably hundreds of boxes of documents from that county, but I would have to look through it all myself, and I don't have the time. or the resources to do that. So this is extremely lucky. I found this the easy way. The third score was a fully working Comet 8. So I found this magazine called Kometen, talked about it just before. And in one of these episodes of that, in one of these releases, there was a list of every employee at ICL who worked with these machines. And I took all their names, looked up the phone book, and found every... Well, it's not a phone book, it's a website, but yeah, you get the picture. And found everybody with those names and called them and said, "Hello, I know this might be a funny call, but did you by any chance work for so-and-so company in 1985? That gave me some fun calls, but after a couple of hours, I found a guy who worked for ICL. And he would like to talk to me, so I drove over there. That was a couple of hours of drive. And he gave me some documents, and he said, "Oh, by the way, I think I have one of the computers as well. Do you want that?" And I was like, "Oh, yeah, sure, I run that, please." And he went out in the garage looking for it and came back like, "Oh, well, I just remembered my wife made me throw it out 5 years ago." I drove home. That happens. Would have been cool to have one of these machines, but not today. I didn't get home. I drove like 2.5 hours. Then the guy called me back and say, "I found it. It's in the ceiling. I hid it from my wife. Can you please come and pick it up before she notices it?" So I drove over there again the next weekend to pick up the computer. The wife had noticed it, the machine, but by then he had convinced her that I would really like to have it. So he was allowed to keep it until I could come and pick it up. Yeah, so fun times. Now I want to change track a little bit and give you some general hints and advices if you want to do this yourself based on what I taught myself. First of all, doing interviews. I've been doing a lot of interviews and I have made some experiences I would like to share with you. First of all, come prepared. Have pictures, have documents, anything you can think of. If you start talking about something and the guy needs his memory, guy or girl, needs his memory kicked, it is super nice that you can just find the newspaper article in question and show it to him and say, "See, you recognize that?" And he will look at it and say, "Oh yeah, I do, now I remember." So, come prepared. Take notes. You are not going to take super detailed notes, but just, first of all, sitting with a pen and paper and writing things down makes you seem serious. So the person knows that you are trying to do your best at this. If you're just sitting laid back and blabbing away, it might be hard for some, at least when they are old, to realize that you're actually focusing on what you're doing. Don't record video. So I do video myself, and this is not a documentary we're making. We are doing an investigative interview. You shouldn't try to do both at the same time. You would do a half-assed job. If you really need to make an interview, get a crew. Get somebody to run the camera and run the sound, and you focus on your subject. Another thing is that these relatively old people often don't want to be video filmed. It's not like us relatively younger guys or girls who do it every day. For them, it was huge a step. It was quite a step to be in front of a camera. So asking somebody who might not remember exactly everything to be in front of a camera, that's quite a big ask. Asking them if you can bring a sound recorder and record the sound is often way easier to get permission. So record sound. Nobody have ever said to me I couldn't record the sound. But a lot of them, even though I didn't ask for video, said, "You can record sound, but please no video," even though I didn't ask for it. So that's a very touchy subject, and I don't even want to ask it. If I ever need to make a video about this process, I can find a way to either recreate the interview or I can ask the person again. That's not important compared to getting the information in the first place. Focus on the most important task, get the information, and think of the presentation at a later point. This is a process. You get smarter all the time. And I try to illustrate that in my own version of the cult learning circles, which I call the learning cycle, Mike's version. So you start out with your current knowledge. You investigate based on that current knowledge. That expands your knowledge. And now that your current knowledge is greater than what you started with, you have more subjects to investigate, which will then expand your knowledge. And this is a circle that, in essence, can run forever. The hard part, for me at least, is to figure out when forever is going to stop and when I need to stop researching and start writing the book. I'm close to it. I can feel it now. I'm really, really close to having to say, stop. I need to start writing now because my sources keep growing. And that brings me to this point, who is about organizing sources. I do physical prints of everything and put it in these binders, organize it, and I make an index so I can find everything. I also keep digital copies. If somebody gives me a physical print, the physical print goes in the binder and I scan it and organize it in the computer on the same way. And of course, I have off-country backups. Most of these documents are one-off. The documents from this old guy who died, Jørn, will most likely, I can't find them again if I lose them. So I'm not going to leave them in my apartment and on my computer and not have a backup. So I have a backup in Germany and another one in Finland and another one in Copenhagen and another one in Jutland. So I got 4 copies of everything. To organize what I do, I make to-do lists and I put points on what to do. So if I find a new name I need to research, I'm going to put that there, research this name. And I have a to-do list for like going to the local archive or to the national archive or for going to the library, search this term, or this term. And this to-do list keeps growing. And every time I've done something, I move it from the to-do list to the journal. Like, for instance, let's say I should go and research Børge Christensen. I will put it on my to-do list. And when I've done it, I'll write in my journal, I researched about Børge Christensen this and this way, and I found this and this and this. The documents I found will have individual source numbers, and I'll put them in a folder, both on the computer and on the shelf. And I will write in my journal who I talked to, how I got the information, and where I put it. So that when I need to write the book, and I need to figure out what I know about Børge Christensen, I can search my journal. And the journal will refer to whatever I have of physical copies of books or documents or photographs. Also, if I get permission, like, can I print this picture in my book? I will note down the permission and also make a copy of the email with the permission or the physical document and put that in the folder as well. So I have that all organized with a unique number for every piece of material. So I'm not sure that this is the right way of doing it, but this is the best way I found of keeping this in a practical way. I'm using a private wiki for this. So all the journal and the to-do list and a lot of other notes like that is on a wiki, on a server somewhere where I have encryption and proper password behind VPN and all that. Then I bought a good multifunctional printer and a book scanner. Book scanner was expensive, 3,000-4,000 kroner, but it has saved my beep a lot of times. And the multifunctional printer is just a good scanner and a decent printer, but I don't count on the prints for anything. When I print something, I still expect the original to be the digital file. And if I scan something, I know that the scan is relatively good. And with all the sources organized and stored in a safe and available space, I am pretty confident that I'm ready to start writing in about a month or two when I have finished the last part of the source gathering, because I have quite a few sources yet to go out and organize and collect. So I hope you enjoyed this talk, and I hope you learned something from it. If you got any questions, then I will be available in the Q&A room right after this session. You are very welcome to contact me through social media. Please go check out my YouTube channel, and then I guess I see you in the Q&A room.